Welcome to today's occasional lecture. You would be aware that there are some dramatic events going on in the building today. We have a meeting of the Council of Australian Governments where state premiers, state and territory premiers come to bargain with the Commonwealth about very important financial matters. We've also just had an announcement that will affect the Senate in that the leader of the Australian Greens, Senator Bob Brown, has just announced he's stepping down from that leadership position, and his deputy, Senator Christine Milne, has been elected in his place. So you can come to work on a Friday thinking, oh, just a Friday, a non-sitting week, just a quiet week, quiet day. But that's right, yes. I should have known this morning that as it was Friday the 13th, unusual things might be happening. But all that is beside the point, because today I'm delighted to say that we're returning to one of our core interests in this Senate Occasional Lecture Series, which has been going for well over two decades, and that is the Australian Constitution and its development. And it's a great pleasure that we have today with us Professor William Buss. He's the O.K. Patton Professor of Law Emeritus at the Iowa College of Law at the University of Iowa, and he's been visiting Australia at the College of Law at the ANU. He has a long-standing interest in matters of Australian constitutional law, and it's no surprise that he's interested in the work of Andrew Inglis Clark, who drafted the original version, I suppose, of what became our Constitution. That Constitution drew very heavily on the US Constitution, but the magic of Clark's work, I think, is that in Andrew Inglis Clark's draft of the Constitution, he managed to meld together both the federalist structure of the American system with the idea of responsible government drawn from the UK. So as a constitutional founder, he is, I think, without parallel. But it's on a particular aspect of the Constitution that Professor Buss is going to talk to us today, and to have a look at some of those intersections between Australian and American constitutional law. And his topic today is the strange case of privileges and immunities. So please join me in welcoming Professor Buss to talk to us today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rosemary. It's a great pleasure to be here, a great honor to be here. And I have to start off by saying I can't resist saying that notwithstanding the connection between responsible government and separation of powers, Clark hated responsible government. So it got here despite him. He had a very bad experience in his own life with the Privy Council dealing with responsible government. So I want to start by just a few kind of preliminary comments before I get to the strange case of privileges and immunities. And I want to sort of make a correction. I was looking over this flyer, and it says, currently he is working on a book on the American influence in the making of the Australian Constitution. And even though I've described what I'm doing in that way for a long time, for the first time it occurred to me that there really is something very misleading about that. The American influence in the making of the Australian Constitution sounds a little bit like a lobbyist group, Citizens United or someone here, trying to get the Australians to do what would be in the American interest. Now, in fact, what I really am talking about is the Australian framers who got to the job of making a constitution and looked around to see what was available to help them, and they took a very hard look at the American Constitution and found it that it was influential, but influential in a lot of different ways, one of which is providing sort of a model for them to follow, as they did, for example, in the case of Chapter 3 dealing with the judiciary, which if you pick up Chapter 3 and Article 3 of the American Constitution, you would see that there are places where you could put one set of words over the other, and except for words like the United States and the Commonwealth, they would be exactly the same words. So there's a tremendous overlap in that area. So there's a real positive modeling, if you will, on the American Constitution. At the other extreme, there are a number of places where the look at the American Constitution was to tell the Australian framers, we don't want to do that. For example, right now I'm working on an article with my daughter, who is also a law professor in the United States, about family law. And when the Australian framers looked at what the Americans had done with family law and what it had caused, they said, that's a scandalous result, and we're going to stay as far away from that as we can. So there's warnings as well as good advice. And then there are these kind of funny in-between cases, and that's, I guess, where we get to the strange case of privileges and immunities. I've prepared this very simple little outline so that'll enable you to kind of follow where I am in this talk. I'll just tell you in advance that the first seven items on the list are pretty much about the American Constitution. The items 8 to 15 are pretty much about the Australian Constitution, and items 16 and 17 are a little bit something special if we have time to do that. So first of all, I need to sort of insist that you just take at faith what I'm going to say about privileges and immunities. Privileges and immunities is a traditional phrase used long back into English history, and it's sort of at the same time, it's very vague and yet pretty specific. It's vague in the sense that exactly which rights and freedoms are part of privileges and immunities is always something that has to be discussed and worked out. But on the other hand, it's sort of repeatedly clear that it's talking about fundamental rights. Privileges and immunities means fundamental rights. Now, identifying those fundamental rights is not always easy, but that's something that I want you to sort of accept, that will be repeatedly the case as we talk about this term as I go through. Now, my second item here is Bill of Rights, and of course I'm talking about the American Constitution now, and I think it's important for me to start by saying the Constitution which the Americans ratified in 1788, notice several years after the end of the Revolutionary War, because right after the Revolutionary War, they didn't have our current Constitution. They had a thing called the Articles of Confederation, which was pretty awful, and the people who we think of as the American framers, like George Washington and Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, said, we've got to do something about this, and what they did was make the American Constitution ratified in 1788. Now, that Constitution did not have any Bill of Rights. It was only later that it was added in 1791. What happened is James Madison, before the ratification conventions in the several states, 13 states at that time, made it pretty clear that they wanted a Bill of Rights. And so when James Madison went to the first Congress, he initiated what turned out to be as the first eight amendments of the American Constitution, which are commonly called the Bill of Rights. So we get to the next point, three, the United States Article 4, and notice there's a little asterisk there, and you can look at exactly what it says, and that's the whole of what it says. Here we have a privileges and immunities clause, but notice it is a privileges and immunities clause that is a state privileges and immunities clause. And what it really is saying is that in the United States, if you're a citizen of one state and you move into another state, you are entitled to these fundamental rights or fundamental privileges and immunities if the state provides them to their own citizens. Now, so there's the state privileges and immunities concept. The Bill of Rights, which does not have the first eight amendments, does not have a Bill of Rights, that only applied to the national government. So, for example, freedom of speech, one of the obvious entities in the Bill of Rights, is only a guarantee, according to those first eight amendments, is only a guarantee against things that the national government might do to interfere with the freedom of speech. Does not control state or local government at all. So now going back to Article 4 and what I have written down here as race and citizenship, Dred Scott. The first, what would it be, 60 years of the American Constitution were very, very bogged down in arguments about slavery and race. And one of the big issues was whether black people, and not just slaves, but free black people, were citizens entitled to these privileges and immunities. And the answer that the Supreme Court gave in the Dred Scott case, Dred Scott versus Sanford, probably the most infamous case in American constitutional law history, the Supreme Court said, no, black people were always understood not to be fit to be citizens. And indeed, he said, why, if they were citizens, they would have these rights, and it's unthinkable that they would have these rights. Let me just read a partial quote from Chief Justice Taney's Dred Scott opinion. And what he's describing is what people would have, including black people, if they had citizenship rights. They would be able to move freely to another state and to sojourn there as long as they pleased, to go where they pleased at every hour of the day or night without molestation, and to have full liberty of speech in public and private upon all subjects, to hold public meetings upon political affairs, and to keep and bear arms wherever they went. So he said, these are the kinds of things that it's inconceivable that the framers of the American Constitution would have wanted black people to have. So that's not a very happy message. The 14th Amendment came along in the United States after the Civil War, and the first sentence of the 14th Amendment, two asterisks for that one, and that's also at the bottom of the page, makes it clear that all persons of whatever race born in the United States are citizens of the United States and of the state in which they reside. So that was good news. And then secondly, in the 14th Amendment, we have a second Privileges and Immunities Clause, and that's quoted at the bottom of the page. Now notice that this is a Privileges and Immunities Clause that seems to make up for that gap that was created by the original Bill of Rights. Remember I said it was only applicable to the national government? Notice that the 14th Amendment says, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. So that certainly made it sound as though the federal constitution now had made their Bill of Rights much broader. And I will give you another one of those statements where I'm telling you to accept it on faith. The consensus of American scholars today is that the Privileges and Immunities Clause in the 14th Amendment was clearly intended to incorporate or make relevant, make applicable all of the Bill of Rights with respect to state action as well as federal action. And that's that happy news lasted only as long as it took to get to the case called the Slaughterhouse Cases, unfortunately an unto suggestive term. The Slaughterhouse Cases held that the 14th Amendment Privileges and Immunities Clause didn't do any such thing. All it did was make applicable to the states certain rights which were already in the Constitution. The dissenting opinion in the Slaughterhouse Cases said, well, that's crazy. If that's all it does, then the 14th Amendment Privileges and Immunities Clause has done nothing. It's a dead letter. It adds nothing to the Constitution. And that has been the understanding in the United States ever since, that the Slaughterhouse Cases almost read the Privileges and Immunities Clauses out of the Constitution. So that is, on that happy, unhappy note, I'm going to move on to the eighth point and talk a little bit about Australia. Before I do, I just want to emphasize the significance of the Slaughterhouse Cases, because it isn't sort of obvious, and it's a little bit technical perhaps sounding to say, well, only if still applies to the national government, these fundamental rights. But what it meant then and for a long time after is that the fundamental rights of black citizens were left to the protection of the states. And the states, particularly in the South in the United States, were not protecting them. So for a very long period, there was discrimination, lynching, murders that were unremedied, a very unhappy result. Be a little bit strong to say that the slaughterhouse cases did it all by itself, but it certainly played a significant role. So now I want to talk again about Andrew Inglis Clark and repeat the point that he brought to the 1891 Australian Convention a full constitution. That is a draft of a constitution ready to go. And he wrote a memorandum that accompanied that draft, and the memorandum said that it was expressly based on the Constitution of the United States of America. So what's that got to do with the Privileges and Immunities Clause? Well, it turns out nothing, because he didn't include two Privileges and Immunities Clause. He didn't even include one Privileges and Immunities Clause. And that's the way things stayed for a while. The framers of the Constitution met before Easter in 1891, and the drafting committee, of which Samuel Griffith was the chair, worked on the Constitution, and they did various things. And then, over Easter weekend, Griffith took the drafting committee on a voyage. He actually went to the Hawkesbury River. John Lanois, the historian professor, said the beautiful Hawkesbury River, which I think it's the same river that Kate Grenfell calls the Secret River in her novel by that name. In any event, over Easter weekend, he took his drafting crew on this ship called the Lucinda, which was the ship of the government of Queensland, which he brought with him, he having been the premier of Queensland at that time. And the most significant drafting of the 1891 convention took place on Easter Saturday, 1891. So it's just, you know, almost to the day, I think 121 years ago. They sailed out of the Hawkesbury River, returning to Sydney, but still no Privileges and Immunities Clause. Now, the next thing that happened is slightly controversial, but I have to go back a step. Clark, Inglis Clark, was a member of the drafting committee, but he didn't make the cruise to the Hawkesbury River. He was sick in bed with flu. So, as the story goes, when the Lucinda came back into the harbor in Sydney, they picked up Inglis Clark, and at that point, he added a Privileges and Immunities Clause. Now, it's a great story. It's not a photograph, of course. This is a painting that was done of the event a few years ago. If you see the people over there in the rowboat, I think the picture is intended to show Inglis Clark being rowed out to the Lucinda. That's the Lucinda, the steamship there. At the time the picture was painted, no one knew where this happened. So they did some consultation of people who might have had some idea, and they finally concluded that the most likely place was where the Opera House is now. So if any of you can imagine that, that's at least where the painting is supposed to be of, that location. One final problem. Inglis Clark himself, in anything I've ever read, never claimed that he was the author of the Privileges and Immunities Clause. And indeed, in the book, by the Kneesys, they say specifically, it's only a matter of speculation that he did it, because who else would have done it? I think everyone who writes about this sort of assumes that he did, and it's hard not to assume that he that he was the one, because it is hard to imagine who else it would have been. But in any event, at that point, there was a privileges and immunities clause. And remember now, we have Clark, who's very aware of the American Constitution. We have these two privileges and immunities clauses in the American Constitution. Which one was it? Well, most people say it's a mixture of the two. And indeed, when you look at it carefully, it's a little bit unclear which of the two it was. But if the Constitution that was drafted at that time had been approved by Australia, that clause would have been in there. But as you probably know, in 1891, the Constitution was not approved, and it sort of was on the back burner for a while. In 1897 and 98, the Constitution came back into the picture and was finally approved in 1898 by the framers, and that eventually, through a couple of other things, became a British statute in 1900. The interesting thing that happened along the way to approval is, even though in 1891 no one had raised any questions about, let's say, Clark's clause, in 1891 Clark raised the question about Clark's clause. That is, he was not a member of the convention in 1897, but he was very active and in touch with the convention, and he had a new proposal, another privileges and immunities proposal, and he basically said that 1891 proposal isn't very good. But he didn't say it was my proposal. He just said it wasn't very good. So then there was a big debate in the Australian Constitutional Convention. And in that debate, first of all, the clause that Clark then preferred, that is the one he wrote in 1897, was voted down. And then finally, the one that he arguably had written in 1891 was voted down. So at that point, no privileges and immunities clause in the Australian Constitution. A short time later, Josiah Simon, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, introduced another privileges and immunities clause. And this one, Simon said expressly, is exactly Article 4 of the American Constitution. So that was debated a while. It was finally approved, but only after they took out the privileges and immunities words and simply said, no discrimination against non-citizens. So is it a privileges and immunities clause without privileges and immunities? Well, some of you are familiar with the great constitutional treatise by Quick and Garen, published in 1900, before the Constitution even became official. And they take an interesting view on this. They say, well, of course, it's unthinkable that all discrimination against out-of-state citizens would be prohibited. So it's only those things involving privileges and immunities. And they specifically quoted an American Supreme Court justice who, in the case that they were quoting, was interpreting Article 4 of the American Constitution and saying this is what is the limitation. It's only privileges and immunities. One more thing from Quick and Garen. They also said, oh, yes, then there's this other privileges and immunities clause in the American Constitution, and that's in the 14th Amendment, and we don't have one in our Constitution. But don't worry, because it doesn't make any difference. They cite the Slaughterhouse cases, and they say, ever since the Slaughterhouse cases, the American 14th Amendment privileges and immunities clauses don't mean anything. And so we're just as good as they are. We have nothing, but they have nothing, even though they have some words in there. Now, I have on my list a statement, the racial factors, positive, negative, and American. And I just want to read three things. The one that I'm calling the negative is when in the convention, the same Quick, who was the author of the treatise, said, "We have already eliminated interstate citizenship on the," and he's talking about this Clark privileges and immunities clause. "We've already eliminated interstate citizenship on the ground that it might interfere with the right of each state to impose disabilities and disqualifications upon certain races. In other words, we don't want anything in our Constitution that's going to prevent the states from discriminating on the basis of race. Well, then the positive, this is a quote from Henry Higgins, and this is a statement that he made right before the approval, remember, without the privileges and immunities language, of this proposal that Simon had submitted, saying we don't want any discrimination against citizens. And what Higgins said is, we want discrimination based on color. That is, it's okay to discriminate on the basis of race as long as you don't discriminate on the basis of state citizenship. That's the thing that's prohibited. And then finally, why do I say the Americans get back in here? I'll just read one quote from William Trenwith, who was actually the only labor representative in the convention. And this one quote is really a very short version of a lot of things that were said in the course of 45 pages of the convention transcript. He said, "The Americans made a mistake by declaring the Negroes should be citizens." So we don't want to go down that road. I'm getting pretty close to the time that I should stop and take questions. I do want to mention this last thing about Clark, only as a way of sort of saying it's really hard to understand sometimes what's happening when you have one group of people looking at one constitution and then advocating something for their own constitution. Remember, Clark was the advocate of these privileges and immunities provisions, and they were voted down. He thought that was a terrible result because he thought what the Americans had done was so wonderful. But he then also wrote a treatise in 1901, and in his treatise, he praised the slaughterhouse cases. Now, I've never been able to understand that. All sorts of reasons, ways to speculate, but the fact is, he did. And so there's the mystery at the end of the Clark connection to privileges and immunities in the United States. Briefly, the end of racism in United States and Australia, well, we all know, not quite. We don't have at all the same racial climate now that we had then, but we haven't quite got to the sort of perfect racially neutral time. The Americans have partly improved their situation by finding another provision in the Constitution that did protect blacks against discrimination and did incorporate the Bill of Rights so that now it does apply to the states and local government as well as to the federal government. And that was, as I say, that was done partly through the Constitution of the United States. The Australians have reached a better world, if you will, not through a Bill of Rights, not through anything that is binding on the government, state or national, but through statutes, common law, international treaties. And I'm not going to end this talk by telling you who's right and who's wrong. I will simply say that the question, should there be a Bill of Rights in Australia, is one that continues to be debated and is always rejected when it is debated. There's even a view that Australian exceptionalism is the way to describe the fact that Australia is the only one of the sort of English-speaking democracies compared to Canada, New Zealand, the United Kingdom itself, and the United States, who doesn't have anything like a Bill of Rights. But at least at this time, that's the way things are. So thank you very much.
Either side of the auditorium, but perhaps I could kick off with one myself, and that is, while you say that Australia, unlike Canada, New Zealand, UK, doesn't have a Bill of Rights, we do have a High Court that hasn't been backward in finding all sorts of implied rights in our Constitution. Do those other jurisdictions have a body like our High Court that has been so active in that field? Perhaps you'd like to comment on that.
Yes. although the differences are that as you've pointed out, in none of the other countries that I listed have they achieved what I'll call enlightened views about individual rights through some of the imaginative things that your court has done. I mean, it's even a little misleading to say that there are no Bill of Rights provisions in the Australian Constitution. There is a religious provision, which is very much like the religion provisions in the American Constitution. There, of course, is the Section 117, which is this offshoot of Article 4, which is kind of an individual rights provision, certainly. But on the other hand, the Australian High Court has teased a great deal of Bill of Rights type protection, for example, out of the Chapter 3, that the notion that there are certain things that, as a matter of, you like to call it, the rule of law, require fairness in judicial proceedings. And so you can read the requirements that Chapter 3 directing how the courts operate as a source of certain kinds of individual rights. The court, of course, has also found a so-called implied right of political communication, which is sort of like the First Amendment, a little bit more limited. Canada, the United States haven't had to do that because they've had the stuff there in writing. But I think that it's clear that in all countries, if there is a court which has any kind of judicial review, that court is going to have difficult decisions to make that affect individual rights, and it of course is always claiming, and I don't mean pretending, but I mean it relies on interpreting the Constitution, and it's not quite a dictionary exercise of figuring out what words mean. It's trying to make sense out of a Constitution as a whole. And so even though, you know, I said no to your question or yes to your question, that there are activist courts, and it goes up and down. I mean, I think a lot of people would say in the United States right now the court is too activist in a non-individual rights direction. Well, maybe that's enough of an answer to that question, to the extent there was one.
We have a questioner coming down the stairs on our right. No? No, sorry. Do we have any other questions? Yes, would you like to make your way to the microphone?
One of the interesting things that's happening in regard to our constitution at the moment is the issue about Aboriginal or Indigenous Australians' recognition in the preamble with regard to discrimination, and I'd just be interested to hear what your thoughts might be in regard to whether that's a disc.
Well, let me say two things. The first one is that I don't know kind of the narrow specifics of that conversation and that discussion. So I don't really have a view on that. I think, I know the history of the treatment of Aborigines in Australia, which, I guess that compares favorably with some of the treatment of racial minorities in the United States. And it seems to me that to the extent that it would be helpful to include a sort of declaration that probably wouldn't have legally binding effect in the sense of deciding cases. It would be a declaration of the purpose, the attitude of the country in the same way that I guess the Rudd government's apology would have done, and I would certainly be in favor of that. I think that you might call it a symbolic act, but I think symbolic acts can be very important. Anyways.
I have a question following on from that, please. As you will be aware, it's nice to have these things spread out in law and have some lovely words, but in your view, as a relative outsider, and we're all outsiders apart from our first Australians, how do we improve relations with our first Australians? Thank you.
I really think I should probably not try to answer that. Let me put it this way. If I were here, and if I were an Australian citizen, I would want to do that. And then I have to figure out how to do it. And I think there's always the problem of gestures and symbols that are important, but then there are very real practical problems as well, and dealing with them. That is figuring out ways to not just to say we like you or wish things were better, but to really make them so is difficult. I mean, I can just tell you that in the United States you have sort of, at this point, at the time of your convention, you had two, perhaps more, but at least two racial problems. One was with Aborigines, and I think that the framers were probably not primarily worried about Aborigines because they thought they were dying out. But they also had a problem with Chinese and other racial minorities who were thought to be taking work from Australians. So you've got different kinds of problems there. In the United States, we have racial problems that are all related to slavery and the attitudes about slavery and the inheritance of that. We also have a problem with American Indians. So in a sense, they come closer to be in the position of Aboriginal people in Australia. That is, people who were here, people who whose land, let's say, was taken over. At least it wasn't a friendly negotiation by any means that resulted in what happened. So we have all those problems in the United States, and I think it's fair to say that we have not solved the question, the best way to deal with Native Americans or American Indians. And all I can say is we have to keep trying.
I think it's one of those uncomfortable things about both of our histories that certainly in the case of the Australian Constitution, it was an overtly racist document. It did provide for discrimination. And I think it's something that we find difficult to come to terms with now and to rationalise it. And hence the need to keep trying.
Yes, I wrote a quote down that I decided I didn't have time to read because I was running out of time, but I think we're rightly concerned about the treatment of racial minorities in the past and now and how we do better. I think it's easy in both the United States and Australia to be sort of moral judges of our framers, and I think one has to be careful about that. I mean, I think that without approving or discounting some horrible things that people did, that they were different times, and it doesn't mean that the Australian Constitution is a bad constitution because there were some bad motives in some parts of it. The quote that I was going to read is from Gordon Wood, from his book, The Idea of Americans, Reflections on the Birth of the United States. Here's the quote. Gordon Wood is probably the leading American historian on the Revolution and immediate post-Revolution period. He says, Yet, despite his repugnant views on race, Thomas Jefferson still has something to say to us Americans today. So my feeling is that one somehow has to have room for both the serious criticism and also the big picture about other things that people did.
Good afternoon, Professor. I think our two constitutional developments and our history have run on similar lines. I mean, our slaves were convicts, and our Aborigines were your North American Indian populations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as Rosemary says, our constitution was clearly racist in its final framing. It always seemed extraordinary to me that a constitution could be based under God, all men created equal, and then go from there to, for over 100, close to 200 years, discriminate against some of the citizens of the United States. Having said that, would you like to make some sort of comment in terms of the development framing of the US Constitution in relation to the history of Great Britain? It always seems the people I meet in the States seem to assume from parliamentary tradition, for example, that everything started in the United States after the United States was formed, whereas many, if not all, the traditions actually have some sort of antecedents in British tradition. Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure I have much of a useful comment because I totally agree with your last statement. And I guess I would add that the American framers, most of them, were quite aware of that and really thought that the United Kingdom, Great Britain then, had the best government in the world. They wanted to do it just a little bit better. But it wasn't at all a case of disavowing. It was a case of, I think it'd be fair to say, exaggerated notions of wrongdoing to them by the British. A lot of Britons at the time wondered how we could think we were being so badly treated by the British and yet have slaves. It's not just that we kind of exaggerated our own harsh treatment and taxation without representation and so on, but we were engaged really right up to the time of the revolution in a very intellectual dispute with the government of England, and the basic dispute was whether sovereignty has to be totally unitary or whether a divided sovereignty was possible. So there were certainly many Americans who became revolutionaries in the end who thought really pretty much right up to 1775 and 1776 that this was a problem that we would be able to work out if only the British would concede that we had a certain level of independence. Now, I've never been clear about whether the British treatment of Australians profited from their experience with the Americans, where at least arguably they were too stubborn. We were stubborn, of course, too. But I just don't know, because I've read a lot of things that suggest that, for example, in connection with the transportation policy, that the British were pushing transportation on the Australians long after very many Australians were strongly opposed to that, and it's understandable why they would be. And the British finally did back down. So I don't know whether they learned or whether just in the nature of things, when you're a world power with a world empire, it's inevitable that you're going to think of yourself first and your colonial outpost second.
Professor Buzz, this may be too difficult to answer for you, but I'll try.
These questions have been too difficult to answer.
Which of the two constitutions, the American or Australian one, do you believe serves the country better? So it could be like apples and oranges and perhaps too hard to compare. And the second part to the question is there anything that you feel particularly strongly about that you would think ought to be changed in Australia?
Well, first of all, let's just repeat, yes, it's too difficult to answer that question. I don't know. I guess I don't think that that Australia ought to have a Bill of Rights. But I guess if I, you know, again, if I could transplant my views and then sort of imagine that I'm here, I probably would be on the side of the people who are advocate a Bill of Rights. Do I think that's sort of more important than everything else? No, but I don't, you know, for example, I know are some very active efforts right now being made to change the Constitution in connection with the treatment of Aboriginal people, and that seems to me to be a quite important thing. As you probably know, that the one amendment to the Australian Constitution that was overwhelmingly passed by the Australian people was the one that took the exception in the treatment of people of another race. There was an exception in the Constitution for Aboriginal people, and when the High Court got around to interpreting that, they said, well, that doesn't necessarily mean exception in a good way. It could be exception in a bad way. So in other words, it doesn't require that it's only affirmative kind of treatment of racial minorities that is permissible. That seems to me, I don't know, maybe it's a right decision, but it seems to be a most unfortunate decision if that is the correct reading of the Constitution.
Professor. This way. Yeah. Over here. At the time of the revolution, it was not just English and members from the United Kingdom in the what was to become the United States. You also had Scandinavian, French, Spanish, Prussian. What influence did the non-English settlers have on the formation of the Constitution?
I'm embarrassed to say that I have no idea.
Okay.
You know, the one thing that we do know, and I'm sure you know, is that militarily speaking, we got an incredible amount of help from the French.
Yes.
We probably wouldn't have been able to succeed in the war without it. And you know, that didn't have too much to do with there being French people in the United States. You know, the British and the Americans together having just defeated the French in the war over the control of Canada before that. But I don't know the answer to your question about what role these other ethnic groups or national groups might have had. I just don't know.
Ernst.
Professor Buss, could you comment on the general unwillingness of both the United States Supreme Court and the Australian High Court to draw on international human rights instruments in cases that involve human rights issues? You'll be aware that in Australia we've had one former judge, Justice Kirby, who regularly drew on international human rights instruments to throw light on provisions in our constitution where he found ambiguity or uncertainty, but the other members of the court have generally rejected that approach. And in the United States, most of the judges, with the exception, I think, of one case involving treatment of a minor, have been almost derogatory about the concept of drawing on international human rights instruments. And it seems ironic that two countries which have generally high human rights standards won't draw on those international instruments. Can you comment on that?
Well, first of all, let me start with Australia and with Justice Kirby, and I am aware of Kirby's position on this, and I certainly agree with your statement that he was sort of on one side of the spectrum in terms of willingness to reading into legislation an interpretation that would be more favorable rather than less favorable to individual rights because of Australia's treaty obligations. Now, turning to the United States, we're a disgrace. I think that our, you know, and there really are two things here. One is the one that you sort of more specifically mentioned, which is what we do with international treaties, and I don't think we're particularly sensitive and responsive in doing that, and certainly, in my opinion, less so than the Australian court. But I think far worse is the American sort of just plain head in the sand unwillingness to look at what other countries, including Australia, are doing on any particular issue. Now, I think there's a very slow movement in the direction of being more responsive to that, but it's so far it's one or two justices. In fact, I think it was here that I saw Justice O'Connor give a lecture after she had retired from the court and talk very strongly about the wrongheadedness of the American Supreme Court in being unwilling to look at that. Sort of, no one suggests that they should be bound by the law and the interpretation of Australia or any other country in the world, but look at what they're saying. Look at the reasoning. Look at the arguments, and ask yourself whether you can't learn something from that. So I think that the United States has a long way to go on that.
I can see one more questioner there. This is probably our last one. Please go ahead.
Professor, on the question of racism, how do you, in the USA, classify the mixed birth people? Is Barack Obama a black?
That's the question? I'm sorry. I don't know what the answer to that is. I mean, I think Obama is what he is. He's a person of a black father and white mother. And I don't know that we need to call him black or white or neither. And I frankly don't think it should matter. So to the extent that the tradition in the United States, which is hard to live down, is that a racial bit of blood was a taint. That seems to me to be very unfortunate. That is, it seems to me, to the extent that that's kind of consistent with saying, well, if he's half black and half white, he must be black, I don't like that. But what I really like to do is say, well, look, let's talk about something that's important. And that doesn't seem to me to be. Now, I want to be clear, though. I'm not suggesting your question was inappropriate, because a lot of people do think it's important. I'm saying it's too bad that that's the case.
Well, we've ranged very widely. I think that's the end of our questions. So I'd like you to join me in thanking Professor Buss for a very stimulating lecture in which we have covered a huge range of topics based on...
The audience has had a very stimulating group of questions.
Well, that's good. Our audience is always first rate here, Professor.
If they're always this good, I'll say that they're first rate.
Thank you to everybody, and we look forward to seeing you back in Australia and to seeing the book.
Thank you.
Thank you.